It's November here at AZMcast, and we've got some awesome stuff for you. We've got Jared and I talking about, of course, a case, but this time we brought in some backup. We've got Jeff Caldwell, one of our chief residents, as well as Ali Min, discussing the case with us to add more of a perspective from what reasonable people might do.
We follow up that case with yet another case. I know, it's a Thanksgiving miracle. Insert your own Thanksgiving pun there.
Lastly, we've taken your advice, and we've finally gotten some advice from the community. Those people that work outside the walls of academia have come together, and we've asked them all of the questions that you've been asking us. Those few that are still talking to Jared and I sat down with us, and we're going to include these little snippets throughout the next few episodes. But this month, we're going to be talking about a few really important ones, specifically how to get a job. So you may want to pay attention to that one. It's November, it's turkey time, and we hope you guys enjoy. For the past few months, we've been doing a conference recap with Dr. Ali Min for the University Campus Residency and Dr. Anna Waterbrook with the South Campus Residency. What they've been doing is they've been telling us what awesome things we've been doing in conference on both sides. We also have been saying some of the things, if you are a resident and you've missed these conferences, go back and watch it on the Panopto website that we record. But if you haven't heard about it, maybe these are some things that you'd be interested in. However, I was watching TV when I stumbled onto this amazing new technology that we are going to start using here on the podcast. This is going to blow your mind. It's called Twitter. Amazing. Unbelievable stuff. I think there's a really good chance that this is going to catch on and just be like the next mail. So with this Twitter, we've created some online accounts for each of the three residencies within the University of Arizona Department of Emergency Medicine. The university campus, the South Campus, and the combined emergency medicine pediatrics residencies each have their own Twitter handle. And we'll be sending out tweets on a weekly basis during conference to keep those of you that are interested in the know about what cool things we're doing in both of the conferences. So I encourage you to follow us on Twitter. I can't believe I just said that. I feel like a car commercial. But nonetheless, follow us on Twitter on the handles below. If you look on your phone or your podcast listening device, you can see the handles right there. University Campus is going to be at UArizonaEM. South Campus is going to be at UArizonaEMSouth. And the Emergency Peds Combined Residency is going to be at UArizonaEMPeds. Seems simple enough. Seems to make sense. So we're going to be expanding our social media presence over the next year, and I'm pretty excited about it. I have no idea how to use Twitter, and thankfully my four-year-old daughter is going to teach me. So we have some of our stellar residents that have also taken up the reins. So look for more to come over the next 4 months, and we'll continue to have Ali and Anna on in some much cooler roles.
A million ways to die.
Ah! Ah! That went south so fast! Ah!
All right, everybody. So we're sure that you're sick of listening to Jared and I talk alone, so we got some help. We got Ali. Say hi, Ali.
Hi.
And we got Jeff Caldwell.
Hey. In my best Nate Holman voice.
Caldwell by name, called very well by reputation.
Oh, I'm blushing.
Yeah, you should be. So we've got a case for this month.
Okay, before we get to your case, though, I want to drop a case because you've nailed me the last couple months.
So I'm editing that out right now.
You can't edit that.
So that's what happens during these recordings.
All right, so are you guys ready for this case?
Yes.
No. Okay, so 30-something-year-old female comes to the emergency department. I'm the ICU attending. Comes to the emergency department and says, I feel like I can't swallow. I have pain in my neck. So, any questions?
Nope. I think that sums it up.
Let's admit her. ICU admit.
Clearly.
Of course. When did it start?
Okay, so she had something similar in January where, so it was probably 6-8 months ago where she had similar symptoms. And all they found was some lymphadenopathy in her neck, but didn't have anything surgical. These particular symptoms started about 5 days ago, and then yesterday got progressively worse.
Any fevers?
No fevers.
And is it difficult? Can she swallow? Can she eat and drink?
We certainly didn't try to make her do either of those things, but she says she was having difficulty swallowing her secretions.
Okay.
How's her breathing?
Her breathing is fine, no stridor. So on exam, she's got some lymphadenopathy. She doesn't really have woody induration like you think for Ludwig's. She definitely has bilateral anterior posterior cervical chain lymphadenopathy and then a couple of supraclavicular nodes that are swollen and tender. So they wanted to get a CAT scan in the emergency department, but they said that she couldn't lay flat. So they called me because they wanted her fiber optically intubated.
Right, right. I don't like can't lay flat.
No, that sounds bad.
I don't like can't lay flat either.
They wanted her fiber optically intubated in order to do the CAT scan?
Correct. My question to you guys is, how would you approach this?
So just to recap,
she doesn't have stridor. She has neck pain. Is she in any respiratory distress at all? Is she tachypneic?
She's kind of whispering. She's not really talking. She's more whispering. Mm. She's not tachypneic. She's not hypoxemic. She's not tachycardic.
Okay.
She just has severely tender, very enlarged lymphadenopathy.
I think the first place I would start would be with a plain film. If I can't get any information, the little bit I'd get from a plain film might help me initially just to see if her airway is distorted and maybe even a chest x-ray as well to see if she's got a mediastinal mass or something crazy like that.
So. No mediastinal mass. She's on the larger side of normal, so a soft tissue neck x-ray isn't really going to be that fruitful.
All right, never mind.
Okay, so she needs to be intubated. Let's just agree to that.
Right.
So how are you going to approach it?
So start with my lemon mnemonic, start to go through and see what her difficult airway predictors are going to be. Does she have a small chin? Does she have a lot of neck to go through? Is she obese? What things am I going to have to worry about in her?
Does she have trismus?
No trismus. Large, not obese. Chin's normal size. Neck mobility is fine. She can open her mouth all the way. You see tonsillar hypertrophy in the pillars, but nothing that really makes you think that you can't get an airway.
So what if you just did a fiber optic scope just to take a look and see if you can get a look at the cords while she's awake? And I mean, if you can see the cords and nothing looks like it's going to be a problem, then I think maybe RSI would be a reasonable option.
So ENT just happened to be around, and they did a NP scope and says to me, I can see the airway fine. I don't think you're going to have any problems with laryngoscopy. And then he ran off to the OR as I was showing up. So I hadn't even seen her yet. He just tells me, I think you can do laryngoscopy fine. So I go and see her, and I was a little concerned, but I also didn't think that there was a reason why we couldn't do laryngoscopy. So what would your plan A is RSI. You do RSI.
Probably. I mean, just if you think that you can get a good look, then I was always taught that you try to optimize your first chance, which would be to paralyze and RSI.
What about you two? What would you do?
Do you know if she's previously been intubated?
No, I don't know.
Okay. Because I would be somewhat... This case doesn't necessarily give you any indication that she has subglottic stenosis, but she's got something in her neck that's unusual. Sounds like it's more dealing with her pharynx, esophagus. She's having a hard time swallowing. She's not having a hard time breathing. So I think RSI would be a fine way to go. If I was working somewhere on my own, I would probably go RSI just because I have not done a lot of awake intubations. But being here with you or with Sackles or somebody who's more experienced in that, I think that would be a great way to go.
Yeah, I have to agree with Jeff that if you've never used one of the fiber optic scopes to intubate with, that is not the time to pick it up when you're by yourself and just trying to muck your way through it. It sounds like it. If I have to suspend reality and for a second and not think of the fact that this is a case you're presenting for the podcast and it's something is going to go horribly, horribly wrong. I think she sounds like a reasonable person to pre-oxygenate, ramp up, and get ready to intubate.
So I agreed. I thought the same thing. I asked my fellow, what's your plan A? He says, well, I think I want to just give her some sedation, put the blade in. If I can see then we'll go ahead and paralyze. I said, okay, I don't think there's any reason why you won't be able to do laryngoscopy. So we give her some Etomidate, a ton of propofol. We had her pre-oxygenated, had her ramped up, put the blade in, could see the airway. So I give the paralytic. He puts the blade back in, can see nothing. Nothing. So I thought, that's interesting. So I took over, and I put the blade in, and I could kind of get a view of the arytenoids, but there was all this tissue just falling in the way. Mm-hmm. I tried to pass the tube, and there was something supraglottic that was just keeping me from being able to pass the tube, and then she started to bleed like crazy, even though, I mean, we were super gentle, and she just started to bleed like crazy. And then she started to desat, so took the blade out and bagged her back up. Now what? Now what would you do?
So you are able to bag her?
Yeah, we got her back up to like 92%.
And what did you paralyze her with?
Sucks.
Okay, so you have the option, although we almost never do this, of bagging her until she's her paralytic's worn off.
Bleeding like crazy now. She's got all that tissue in there that's bleeding.
So my thought is, let's get something a little more definitive than bag. An LMA might seat, but with all of this tissue that's in the way, it might not. But intubating LMA might not be a bad way to go to give you a little bit of help and call that ENT person back and tell them they're a liar and that they better get going.
Yeah, she's not a candidate for surgical airway. She's got too much redundant tissue on her neck. So I tried a second attempt. I said, well, let me get a bigger blade. I got a bigger blade. Positioned her a little bit better, put the blade in there, could not see a single thing except blood. I tried DL, I couldn't see anything. I tried to pass a bougie through, I couldn't get the bougie to pass through. So I put an intubating LMA in, and I said, somebody get me the real bronchoscope. So put the LMA in, we were able to oxygenate her and ventilate her fine with the intubating LMA, and it was one of the ones that had the OG tube port, so I put an OG tube down to decompress her stomach, so we had time. We had our sats up in the 90s. And we got the bronchoscope, and I put the bronchoscope down, and I could see the airway. Couldn't get the tube fast. So I end up getting a smaller tube. I think it just was getting obstructed in the LMA. So I got a smaller tube, heated it up, lubricated the heck out of it, and was able to drive it into the airway with the bronchoscope. But it brings up an interesting... If that failed, I didn't know what I was going to do. Because... You know, you're really in that, not really a surgical candidate, can't really stop, you've gone too far, you can't get something in fiber optically, you can't keep the LMA in. So what do you do? Well, you know, there's different algorithms. There's the anesthesia algorithm, the difficult airway algorithm from anesthesia, and what they say is invasive airway access, you can't get something, can't mask ventilate surgical airway or cancel the case. The Difficult Airway Society from Canada, they have their airway algorithm that says plan A if that fails, and you can keep them oxygenated, and then plan B, and then you go on surgical airways to the last resort. And then the Australian guys, you've probably seen this floating around the internet, the Vortex approach, where they have your best attempt at mask ventilation, your best attempt at intubation, your best attempt at supraglottic airway. And if all of those things fail, you're spiraling out of control. You spiral into a surgical airway. But she's not a surgical airway candidate, and I've already paralyzed her. And so it's incredibly difficult. This is where the LMA really saved me. So long story short, you ready for the end of this case?
Well, I was going to say real quick. So you say not a surgical airway candidate. I think that at a certain point, everybody becomes a surgical airway candidate because they're dying. Like, they're literally dead. And if they go into PEA arrest, I can't say, well, we would cut on her, but, you know, she's got a lot of... Right. Fat. She's got a fat neck, so I guess we're just going to let her die.
To get closer to the lung.
That vortex, when I talked to Sackles about it, I had said, it seems more to me like a toilet bowl of where you're trying, but you're going down the tubes. And I asked him if the vortex goes counterclockwise in Australia and clockwise in the U.S., if that, you know, depending on which hemisphere you're on. I think that's the way to think about it, is keep doing whatever you're going to do, and eventually the sucks would have worn off, and hopefully she starts breathing again. But just to clarify for anybody, like, if she's literally going to die, like she is dying in front of you, I think not a surgical candidate means if you try to cut on her neck, now you've reached a real point of no return because she's going to be a mess.
Correct.
Yeah. But to say, well, we can't try, doesn't it?
And I think the other key that you were talking about is that every attempt you have to change something. Like
right.
You can't keep doing the same thing over again and wondering why it's not working. So getting a bigger blade, smaller tube, your adjuncts, like all that stuff, you need to change your methods each time.
It's not Pictionary. You can't keep saying the same thing over and over again and expect to be right.
Yeah, I'm wondering why it's not working.
Yeah, I was definitely on plan D by the time we got her intubated. You have to work all this stuff out in your mind as you're going. So she got intubated, we get a CAT scan, and there's no abscess, but there's lymphadenopathy everywhere in her head and neck. So I ask surgery to come by and do a biopsy, and they said they think that it's a dental infection. But why would you have adenoid hypertrophy from dental infection? That doesn't make any sense. So I got ENT to take her to the OR. She's got lymphoma. She had reactivation of EBV and has lymphoma.
Yeah, bummer.
And was her tissue just so friable that
yeah,
was just
I think it was so inflamed and friable and hypertrophied that you touch it and it just started bleeding. And I think what happened was I was able to get a view and I paralyzed her and all that stuff just collapsed into the airway and I couldn't see anything. And then it started bleeding because it was so friable.
With the history of this lymph node swelling that you initially put out, I kind of wonder, there's going to be some kind of airway distortion.
Yeah.
She says she has trouble breathing. With the strange airway distortion, that might have been a reason to say, let's try the fiber optic scope. But in retrospect, I've only done two of them successfully, and I've tried maybe two more that I just couldn't get to the cords. And, man, I still don't think I would have done a good job. What I probably would have done is knocked every friable lymph node on the way down and caused a epistaxis on top of her airway bleed, and then we would have been in the same boat, probably with worse bleeding.
Yeah, there's no good route, right? If you try to go nasally, you're going to hit the adenoid. If you try to go orally, I think the reason she couldn't swallow is because of her lingual tonsil hypertrophy. And so your lingual tonsil sits in your molecula, and when that hypertrophies, you constantly feel like there's something in your throat, and you probably feel like you can't swallow, even though you probably are.
What if you just had the blade in her mouth and had the view and push the paralytic like while you have that view?
Yeah, that's certainly an option, but then I don't like doing that because then you got to sit there and wait for the paralytic to start working. If it's rock, that's almost a minute that they're not really oxygenating that much. You know, if you have we had optic oxygenation and all that stuff, but you don't have forever with that.
No.
So I think in review, you have to have a backup plan. Jared had plan D. That's probably two more plans than I would have had. And the Vortex algorithm that Sackles had sent around is that you keep trying different things. You try a supraglottic airway. You try bag valve mask. You try endotracheal intubation. And you try them all in different ways. You go clockwise, counterclockwise, whichever way it takes, until finally you end up at a surgical crike.
You do what you can to keep the patient oxygenated. If you failed, your priority is now keeping them oxygenated until you can move on to another plan.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can't keep them oxygenated and you don't have a good second plan, that second plan becomes surgical airway. If you do have a good second plan, plan B, then you can move on to that.
Good case.
Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm going to let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time.
So before Jared Kanye Wested me, I actually did have a case. So how about we get to that case?
All right, guys, I got another case. Everybody ready?
Uh-huh. Yes.
All right. Ready or not? So a 37-year-old female comes to the emergency department for two-day history of my favorite combo, numbness, tingling, lightheadedness, and dizziness. And I'm immediately trying to sign out this patient because these are probably my least favorite things to take care of. So she says that she's had some vague complaints. She had a sinus infection. She's on amoxicillin. She had a little diarrhea and not eating as well, doesn't feel as hungry. But the biggest thing that worried her today is she looked in the mirror and saw that her right side of her face was droopy compared to the left. And feels numb. Now she's actually having some trouble swallowing. And she's got some numbness that's kind of in the perioral regions, extends up to her cheek. And when you look at her, she visibly has a right-sided facial droop. And she's lying in bed, kind of cocked over to the right side, and talking to you, but looks pretty tired in general.
Any thoughts right now?
Well, you know where my mind automatically goes. I start thinking, you just got myasthenia gravis or Lyme disease or...
All right, let's ask a real doctor.
Okay. You should probably ask one.
Of course, you start thinking about stroke. You do a good neuro exam and see if there's any other focal findings. Electrolyte abnormality, if she's been having, you know, diarrhea and other stuff like that.
Okay.
You say she's looking kind of tired. She's got facial droop, so I'm also wondering, is she protecting her airway? Is she getting fatigue from whatever this neurologic problem that she has is? Are we going to need to intervene and intubate her before we can send her to MRI or wherever else we're going to need to send her?
So she is, here's her vitals. Temp is 37.1, heart rate 62, blood pressure 114 over 79, respiratory rate is 16, and she's got 98% sats on Remer. Your neuro exam, she's got a right-sided facial droop. She has symmetric forehead raise bilaterally. She's got decreased sensation in the trigeminal distribution of all sides of the right side of the face. She also has 5 for 5 grip strength on the left and 4, 3.5 on the right. She has downgoing toes and Babinski bilaterally. She's hyperreflexic on the right side compared to the left.
Sorry. All these things make me think of a central cause, and so less likely to be Lyme disease or Guillain-Barré, but something like a mass in the brain or a stroke of some sort, because where she's able to, she has symmetric elevation of the forehead. That's not a peripheral nerve lesion, that's a central lesion. She's got cranial nerve findings plus findings in the distal extremities.
So that's an important point to highlight is everybody just wants to say, you know, right off the bat, she's probably got Bell's, you know, she's 37, maybe something set her off and now she's got Bell's palsy. So it's important to remember that the lower motor neurons that innervate your face, they are bilaterally innervated by your upper motor neurons. And so if you knock out one of the upper motor neurons, you're still going to have the innervation from the other side. But if you knock out the lower motor neurons, then you're going to get a droop of the forehead as well. So Bell's cannot elevate their forehead. So I usually tell patients in part of my neuro exam to say, all right, close your eyes real tight. Don't let me open them. Now open your eyes real big like you're surprised. And they lift their eyebrows up. And if they can't do that, that's reassuring. If they can do that, then I lift my eyebrows in surprise as well, because crap, now you have a stroke or some kind of central lesion like Jeff was talking about. So she had been having symptoms for 2 days, and she woke up this morning with the sensation that her face was droopy. And this is at about 3 p.m. that she comes to the ED. So anybody want to call stroke?
I mean, it's certainly weird if it's been getting progressively worse for the last 2 days. Mm-hmm. Seems weird to be an embolic stroke.
Seems strange, right? Mm-hmm. Anybody that you would TPA, 37-year-old female?
No.
No? Kind of strange.
After 2 days.
Yeah. 2 days worth of symptoms. Even if the right facial droop just came on today, it's kind of strange that, like Jared said, this has been progressive. So what else is going to be in your differential? Allie talked about stroke. She talked about electrolyte abnormalities. What other kind of things do you put in your mind when you think of stroke mimics? Like, hey, before we TPA this person, let's make sure they don't have something that we can fix right away. What are some of the other things you think of?
Well, there's a couple I would worry about, carotid or vertebral. In her case, it'd be a carotid dissection that could lead to progressively worsening stroke symptoms over a couple of days. And then a cardiac abnormality like a PFO, where you could be launching microemboli for a couple of days.
Okay. Other things I always think
thyroid.
Of. Yeah, thyroid does absolutely anything in my book, because I still don't understand it. It's a mystery to me. So it's like watching a magic trick. Like, I just don't want to know how they do it. I'll just assume that it's the thyroid.
Syphilis.
Syphilis
is the great mimicker, right?
Syphilis, yeah. You can never go wrong with syphilis. The other thing I always think of is hypoglycemia. It mimics a bunch of stuff. So you can have hypoglycemic seizure, hypoglycemic weakness, hypoglycemic pretty much anything. I love the drunk-looking hypoglycemics. Like, yeah, they're just drunk, and don't worry about it. Oh, well, their sugar's 19 as well, so maybe we can fix that. Oh, guess what? They're not drunk. They just had hypoglycemia.
We're talking about stroke mimics now, so the important stroke mimics to rule out: glucose abnormalities, seizures would be unlikely in her because it's been progressively worse after 2 days. With no seizures, you usually get an acute stroke mimic.
Mm-hmm.
Sepsis, doesn't really look like she's got signs of sepsis, electrolyte abnormalities, thyroid. What else? What am I missing? Or cardiac abnormalities.
So I think the big push is going to be if she came in with symptoms for 2 hours, mm-hmm. we'd be, well, we're behind the eight ball. We got to hurry up and decide if we need to TPA her. And we got to make sure in the ED that when we call neuro and we call out a stroke page, what we're doing is saying, hey, neuro, we've got a patient that may need your intervention, but we need to make sure that we look at all the non-neuro stuff before we decide with neuro, okay, TPA candidate, yes or no. So we started looking into some of this stuff. And interestingly enough, one of the things in her past medical history is that she's had issues with parathyroid disease and parathyroid adenomas and has actually had her parathyroids removed and is on calcium supplementation. So her iCal, when we got it, her total calcium was 7.5. For her total calcium.
Albumin was low.
Her blood albumin was actually only 3.7, so it wasn't terrible. But when you do the correction, and this is something pharmacy helped me out with, in order to know what your functional calcium level is, you need to know what your albumin is because the calcium is bound to albumin. So it corrects to about 8 with her albumin. Mm-hmm. And her iCal was about... was 0.90.
iCal is ionized calcium. It's the metabolically active form.
Thank you, Dr. Mosher.
You're welcome. It's helping you out.
So what we did is we decided, well, first of all, you're not a TPA candidate, so that took a load off of my mind. And second, you've got hypocalcemia, so why don't we treat that? We gave her 2 grams of IV calcium gluconate, and lo and behold, her weakness went away. Her facial droop went away. She sat up. She had more energy. She seemed like a more normal person with her family at bedside, and we fixed her quote-unquote stroke with two grams of calcium gluconate. I had never seen that in my life.
That's awesome. Why did you choose gluconate instead of chloride?
We chose gluconate instead of chloride because she had a peripheral IV, and there was no – she wasn't an extremist by any means, had normal vital signs. This had been progressive over 2 days, and the big reason that I would choose it choose gluconate over chloride would be so I don't burn the vein. You know, we don't lose her access. Otherwise, you could give it either way, but I've always been told that calcium chloride is so hyperosmolar, it's just going to burn through your vein. So why lose an IV in a non-emergency situation? Mm-hmm. So it was amazing. We took it ahead CT still. So even though we found, okay, you have hypocalcemia, we didn't just leave it at that. Let's take you to CT. I was fully prepared to take her to MR and call neuro to evaluate her for her stroke, and she got better. I've never seen anything like that. It's always what you hope that you can do is fix somebody with a little bit of drugs, yeah. And tell her, guess what, you didn't have a stroke, but man, you got to get your calcium in order, girl.
That's a great example of if something just isn't adding up or making sense, it's probably not right. Mm-hmm.
Now, it still doesn't make sense to me because electrolytes, much like the thyroid, are a mystery to me. So if she's hypocalcemic, I give her more calcemia, and she got much better. We did. We sent her home. We actually talked with pharmacy about what would be an appropriate dose of elemental calcium for her. We upped her dose a little bit. We made sure she could be compliant with her with this. One of the things that turned out is she just hadn't been eating all that well, had a sinus infection, and had just not been able to take her calcium supplementation.
He's amoxicillin, some kind of calcium chelator.
So I asked about that too. Would it affect anything? And the only thing pharmacy could come up with is maybe it changed her GI flora so that she wouldn't be able to absorb as well, which is a possibility. I know that that'll happen sometimes when you have people on vanc for long periods of time. It'll change their gut flora, and you can have issues with coagulopathy because they don't absorb the vitamin K as well enterically. I mean, crazy stuff that happens. But the key thing I wanted to get across with this case was what Jared had said. If it doesn't make sense, then keep looking. Because it would have been easy to say, well, you got a stroke. I've already ordered your CT, MRI, neuro consult, and I'm going to sign out to the next guy, go to my next couple patients, and completely ignore this lady. And she could have potentially gotten worse if her hypocalcemia had turned into cardiac issues. So
that's what makes you a better doctor than the IBM Watson, right? It's, things make sense to you or not make sense to you.
I hope I'm better. We'll see.
It's a humbling world.
I haven't been out in practice long enough to go up against Deep Blue, so not quite there yet.
My man said he wanted something real, 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 real. Yeah, something he could recognize, something he could feel, 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 feel.
Introduce your cohort, your brain trust.
All right, so you guys have been asking about how to practice medicine in the real world, which Leach and I have no idea about. So we summoned...
Nobody trusts us.
So we summoned a panel of people smarter than us. And we have Nate Arnone. Nate, where do you live? Tell us a little bit about your practice.
So I live in Honolulu, Hawaii. And my group staffs a number of different hospitals, community hospitals. And I work at two of them. There's three on that island, and then three on another island, and then one on an island, and two more on another island. And my group takes care of all of them. But there's a variety of different sizes and volumes.
What kind of obstacles do you have for follow-up for your patients?
Actually, where I practice, it's pretty good, especially compared to my experience living in the community here in terms of the amount of time it would take you to get in to see your doctor. Where I live, I can get someone in probably within 48 hours most of the time, maybe 24 if I call them and ask.
Regardless of specialty, neurology, whatnot.
Yeah, there's a few that are backed up but a little bit, but it's still, for the most part, a reasonable follow-up. And nice. That obviously affects what you do when you're practicing.
All right, and Chris Graham and Emily Osborne, you guys both work in Bend. Tell us a little bit about your practice.
So we work in a community hospital as well. We see between 30,000 and 40,000 patients a year. We have about 18 to 20 partners in our group, somewhere around there. Probably similar, pretty similar practice environment to Nate's in terms of getting people follow-up, especially if you're already tied into a primary care physician. But easily, I think, 24 to 48 hours if you push for it. I think the people that aren't tied into the healthcare system, it can be a little bit tougher. But even that, I think if you really want somebody follow-up and you want to avoid admission, they'll make it happen.
I agree.
Well said.
Brooke, you live in Minneapolis, correct?
I do.
Tell us a little bit about your practice.
So I work for a small Democratic group. We have an inner city hospital in Minneapolis and then one in St. Paul. And then we do some outlying communities with a standalone ER and then a couple of really little hospitals that we staff as well.
Do you have any obstacles for follow-up?
You know, it really depends which site you're at and what your patient population is. We have a lot of Native Americans who have great follow-up with the Native American care, but then we have a lot of homeless people and that sort of thing, which are obviously harder to get to do what you want.
You have a lot of Somalia patients, right?
We have a ton of Somalians.
Any Ebola?
None yet. We've had a couple of scares, but we've not had any diagnoses yet.
Good.
We had a great, I just did my whole PPE, like meth suit training, and we had a great slide of a big picture of the couple countries and then the rest of Africa that just said not Ebola.
And Arthur, you're in Scottsdale?
Yeah, I'm in Scottsdale. We staff three hospitals there. Pretty good access to most of our patients. I will say our level one trauma center that's in downtown Scottsdale, I like to call it like an upscale county hospital. Get a fair number of homeless people. And so for them, follow-up is an issue, and obviously that will change how you dispo them. The other two hospitals, most people there have good access to care, and they have their doctors that are pretty on top of things, so that changes it.
So you guys all have much more experience than Leach and I do. You graduated a year ahead of me, so was that 2009? Mm-hmm. 2009, you've been out in practice for 6 years now, 5 years, and various different experiences, various different practice settings. So we wanted to talk to you about the gray area stuff that when residents ask us, how do I manage this in the real world? We don't really have any answer to. So
I'm going to break in here once real quick just to say that this is the opinion of several docs that have graduated from our program and have been out in practice for a while. The views expressed during the Community Perspective segment do not necessarily reflect the views of the Arizona MCAST editors, myself, Jared, the Department of Emergency Medicine, or other sane people. However, these guys are wicked smart, so I'd pay attention to what they have to say. The views may or may not have been enhanced by ethanol.
TIA or syncope, which of those do you send home? Which of those do you admit?
So our group, our hospital just formed, like our cardiology protocol, we have a TIA protocol where they're seen in TIA clinic the next day. So you just write the outpatient order, follow the TIA clinic.
You tell them to take an aspirin. Take an aspirin and go see them tomorrow.
Go see them tomorrow.
That sounds like hell. TIA clinic.
Yeah, TIA is for us. And Emily can speak to this because she's on the stroke committee. TIA is for us. Everyone come along with a head CT and carotid imaging of your choice. If that's negative and their symptoms have resolved and their lab workup otherwise looks okay.
Wait, you can get carotid imaging in the ED?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing a stroke, if I want an MRI stroke protocol, I'll just do MRI brain neck.
That's exactly.
Be done with it.
For us, it's
usually non-contrast CT of the brain, a carotid ultrasound. And if those look fine and the symptoms have resolved and the labs look okay, it's a phone call to neurology and running it by them.
Yeah, we can get MRAs, but we can't get carotid Dopplers. Yeah.
We can get other carotid Dopplers if we want to. But for us, it's a throughput issue. Like if I think they're fine, or let's say this is their fifth TIA in the last 2 years. You know, and they're not going to do anything differently as an inpatient, they'll just go home. If I think they really need to get their carotids Dopplered, you know, certainly if you found some on physical exam, like, you know, some kind of brewery or something like that, then I'll just admit them at that point. You know, let them do their workup, but it doesn't have to be done stat in ER.
You just said something that was interesting. You said, if I don't think they're going to do anything different as an inpatient. So we all did medicine rotations, but now residents don't do a medicine rotation. So do you think it's important?
Really?
Yeah. Well, they do medical ICU.
They don't do floor medicine.
No. So how important is it, do you think, that they should follow up on their patients to see what happens to them when they get admitted so they can learn what they're going to do as an inpatient or not?
That's important because a lot of times if I call to admit a patient, the hospital is like, what do you want me to do?
Yes.
And you should have that.
Make them leave here?
That's what
I want.
I want you to take them upstairs.
You need to know what you know, and you need to know what you want your consultants to do.
Yeah.
Because if you call and ask them to admit,
and it needs to be one of the first like five words out of your mouth that you've already lost their attention.
Right. It's got to be,
I've got a patient.
Why am I admitting this person?
I've got a blank year old blank. I want you to do blank with.
If you want to look like a buffoon, say, I have no idea what's wrong. I don't know what I want you to do. Here's the patient. And you quickly lose any respect with your hospitalists and your consultants are going to be like, he's an idiot.
I always harp on our residents about two things along these lines. One is hyponatremia and the other is acidosis. You can't call them and say, I have a patient with hyponatremia. What do you want me to do? I want you to just work it out, right? You have to have some kind of indication, some reason why you think maybe they're hyponatremic.
Right.
Same with an acidosis. I have a patient with an acidosis. Well, what do you want me to do? I want you to work it up. You should say, I think they have this. Yeah, this is what I need you to do.
I think, you know, half the benefit of doing, at least for me, of doing all your off-surface rotations during residency is understanding the pain of each consultant service. You know, to call the hospital's team, you said you call the hospital at nights that's already had 12 admissions.
Right.
There's a lot of pain that comes along with that. You know, when you're doing your medicine rotation, and you're talking to your friends down the ED, they're calling you to admit a patient. It's like the last person you want to talk to on the phone.
Yeah, you had the nickname Grumpy Graham when you were on CC.
It's like, understand that pain that comes along with that. And it's all of your consultants. Like, they're doing the service, but it's no fun waking up at 3 in the morning
to
come in and see a patient, regardless of whether you're going to
pay for it. Whose sodium is 125, and they're pretty much fine.
And they're probably going to be fine. It stinks.
Who can eat potato chips?
So to go back, not only did these guys all do medicine, but they all did CCU as well, which is something, thankfully, I didn't have to do either. But this was when CCU admitted all chest pains. There was no, this one goes to medicine.
And there was no cap.
There was no cap.
Every chest pain.
And we were on by ourselves, so the medicine residents would have like an intern and a third year taking their call splitting, and we'd do it by ourselves.
And it snowed, and they went uphill.
I did 20-something admissions, man.
Uphill both ways.
Yeah.
I remember getting the calls from the ED when you're on your off-service rotations. Like, hey, these 18 has chest pain. I'm like, well, can you tell me a little bit more than that? Well, what else do you need to know? I'm like, come on. Yeah, don't be that guy in the community either that calls with a slam dunk admit and tells the consultant nothing.
One of my credos as a resident, and it stayed with me, is your reputation will stay with you for a long time. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to take a job in the community and people are going to think poorly of you, it's going to take a mountain of work to go above that. So do the extra tests, you know, find out if they're going to the OR, when their last meal was, all the stuff that you should do. Because when the surgeon calls, you're like, I have no idea. And then you go talk to the patient, like, I just ate, you know, surf and turf. I had a 25-ounce steak. And it's like, right. It's like, yeah, right. I had some Cheetos in the waiting room and I haven't eaten too nappy, and the surgeon's just, and you don't know, the surgeon, they just get mad, and they're just kind of annoyed, because it's kind of your job, you should know.
But it makes you look incompetent.
Exactly.
You know, it's a surgeon, you know, if a surgeon taking the patient to the OR is going to ask you two questions. What time did they last eat?
And why am I going?
Yeah. And what, you know, if something's going on.
And what's the CT show?
Right.
I'll tell you, when I'm in the ICU, the thing that drives me the most crazy is when they call you to admit a patient, like as they're securing the ET tube, and you say, well, did you check this? Do you know why they got intubated? And the answer is, well, none of that's going to change the fact that they need to go to the ICU. That drives me crazy. So I think I heard one of my CT surgery colleagues once tell the residents that when you call a consultant, don't sound like an amateur. And I think that's important.
No, and in the community, you know, in residency, it's 3 years, hopefully, unless you're really bad. Or you do a combined rotation, you know, residency. Exactly, remedial work. But in the community, I mean, I've been there where I'm at now, like all of us, you know, 5.5 years at my place. And they know you, they know your reputation. And if it's bad, it's going to stay bad. And it's really hard to overcome that because...
But if it's good, it's on the conferences, it helps you.
No, that's how it is for me. It's like, I just call.
Yeah.
I have a great rapport with our general surgeons or trauma surgeons. I just call and they're like, oh, why are you calling me? I had a great case. This guy had a vibrator stuck up his butt. I tried to get it out. I couldn't. And so I call our trauma surgeon. They take general surgery call. Like I think it happens at UNC. And I said, her name is Denise. I said, Denise, I have a rectal form body. I can't get it out. I tried all these different things. And she's like... Okay, I said, oh, and by the way, he's got Hep C and HIV. And she's like, you have to be kidding me. I said, my response to her was, Denise, you know me. Would I call you at 1:40 in the morning and joke about this? And she was like, no, you're right. And she, you know, she was fine. But you don't want to be that guy.
Right.
No. You also sometimes will need your reputation to give you the benefit of the doubt. Like, yes. If you're getting slammed and you just tube that guy and you need him to go up because you've got three other traumas coming in. Mm-hmm. Like, you need to have a good reputation to say, I'm sorry, I'm slammed. I don't know what's wrong with him, but I got hit in the fan. I need you to come take this guy right now.
Yeah, if you show up inept and you purvey that attitude throughout your initial time being whatever your community job is, every phone call to admit is going to be pain in the ass. Mm-hmm. And you don't want it to be like that. You want to be able to pick up the phone and say, hey, I got this, this, and this, and not have an argument.
And you'll even know your colleagues who you know, see in passing because you're both doing separate things, you know, in the ED at the same time. You'd be like, oh, so-and-so just give me so much trouble every time I call them to admit. And you're thinking in your head, really? I've never had them once bat an eyelash.
Right.
You're obviously incompetent.
You're good.
I didn't know that about you.
Point taken.
So like I said, very smart people who have been doing this for a long time. And what I like is not only do they give you their experience of what happens in the community, but throughout this whole time that we discussed with them, they throw in these little pearls of just how to be a good doctor, how to be a good citizen in the place you work, how to survive your day, do well with patients, lots of other really great performance pearls and art of medicine kind of things that you can only learn with experience. So listen to what they say. Take their stuff with a grain of salt because depending on where you work, it may not be applicable. Can you take all of that to your next shift at the university or South Campus hospitals? Probably not. But do you put it in your back pocket and try to bring it back out when you go on to a different job someplace else? Absolutely. So take it with a grain of salt. And this next segment where they talk about getting a job, definitely take this with a much larger grain of salt or smaller. I'm not actually sure how that metaphor works. But listen to what they have to say so that when you're going out on the job hunt, you have an idea of what to do and what not to do, since many of these people are actually doing the hiring at their respective places.
This is for those of our residents that are looking for jobs either this year or next. So what are some things that will absolutely sell you on an applicant? You hear they've done this or they tell you this and you go, man, that's a stellar applicant. And what are the things that will just tank somebody and go, absolutely not will you ever work in my group or anyone around me.
Also, like you probably, I do the hiring for my group now. For me, you know, the biggest thing that
12 year age scotch.
Yeah,
Arthur, exactly. Like
something fancy.
If you're into Scottsdale scotch, easy to remember.
But in reality, I think the biggest thing that'll sell somebody, I don't care about much else other than a couple things. One, if it comes from our residency or any residency we have people with, kind of a big thing is kind of the people I know kind of giving me stamp of approval. That carries a lot of
like Jared and I?
Like Jared and you, for sure. I mean,
really?
It's I can sit with somebody for an hour. You don't really know them, but you spend 2.5 years with somebody, or, you know, 3 years or whatever it is. You can't hide who you are. I think the biggest thing, even if you got a stamp of approval, if you're kind of, you come across unprofessional, and to me, I'm a total stickler. I realize I told my practice administrator who did my interviews with me at ASAP, I was like, man, I feel like I'm becoming like an old man. I look at the interviews, there's like misspellings, there's periods in the wrong places. I'm like, this is driving me crazy. Because to me, the resume is like the representation of you. You've spent so many years getting to the point that you finish residency, and this piece of paper, you can pay somebody $10 to make it look nice, and you didn't even bother, and it looks like crap. That's just, it just means you don't care. And when you show up, you need to be professional. Those are the big things. I mean, that'll just tank you. If you show up, you should take your job interview at least as seriously as you take your residency interview. And if you didn't, you're just wasting your time. I mean, you're applying for a job. I think the average ER doctor is making close to $300,000 a year. Like, you should dress professionally. You should be professional.
Now, I come from a really casual place where I show up in I think I wear a jacket for some of my interviews in Hawaii, and for some of them just a tie and, you know, dress pants. Everyone else is in board shorts and t-shirts, and that's okay to be overdressed in that. I agree with you 100%, but I will say that people in that position, especially around November of your last year of residency, are kind of freaking about, you know, am I going to get a job? Is it going to be where I like? I really want to go here. Am I going to get there? Are they going to interview me? But the bottom line is groups want somebody who are going to like them, and there's going to be a mutual like going on. So they want you to want to be there for some reason. And they want to see that, like, oh, I've got family around here, or I've got some other reason I like this place, and I'm not going to move a year from now after you've spent a year teaching me how to work in this environment. I think that's a huge thing that gets, you know, that doesn't get enough. If you're really interested in a certain place, that's going to come off. And yeah, if you're blowing it off and acting like you're not interested, that's going to come off too.
Yeah, and I would say kind of my number one measure beyond, probably the biggest thing is kind of people that I know tell me what they think of somebody. But number two is what I call the beer test, is do I want to have a beer with this person? Mm-hmm. And that is, I did two interviews. Within 10 seconds, I was like, I'm just going to waste this hour of my life. I'm never going to get it back. But out of courtesy, I just kind of went through it. And you just know, you're like, this is just not the right fit for what we do. And I mean, I wear flip flops every day unless I go to work. You know, I mean, we're pretty laid back regardless of our reputation. But I'm with you. I mean, I think you're spot on. People have to show an interest there. You don't want somebody to go there and then leave. I mean, we put a lot of time, and every group does. Mm-hmm. You want the right person.
And I think another thing about it too is there's going to be a difference between community medicine and academic medicine in terms of your resume. Like, when you're in academic medicine, they want you to have a research interest, and they want you to do that sort of thing. When you're in community medicine, we want you to be a good citizen and with the group. We don't want the person who's going to be the big headache for everyone else who has to work with you. And we want you to, you know, we don't honestly care that you published. I mean, if you publish something impressive, that's wonderful. But most of us have published something super minor that's not impressive.
Right.
And it doesn't really matter what's on your resume.
What?
I mean, truly, it doesn't. You come out of residency, and unless we hear otherwise from people we know, we're going to assume you're competent. You know, we're going to assume that you're going to do a decent medical job. So the part that's left is how you interact with your coworkers and how you interact with the hospital and the patients, because that's how we make money.
And I think everybody here works for a democratic group.
Yeah.
And from that point of view, it's what are your other interests? And basically, can I gauge that you'll be involved? Like, our group is super involved in all sorts of stuff in the hospital. We don't get compensated for that, but that's kind of like the price we pay to be who we are. And so you try to figure that out. I think it's hard.
You made a good point that you can't hide who you are for very long, because people don't realize how small the world really is.
Oh, yeah.
Especially with ER.
Yeah.
And I think most people who are hiring, they're not only talking to their colleagues or friends, wherever that hiree is coming from, but they're talking to the charge nurse or tech or some other, you know, medical specialist that they went to med school with who works there, to say, hey, what do you know about this person? What can you find out? And a lot of, you know, feedback comes from.
Right.
I think groups like to hire as much of a known quantity as they can. You know, they want somebody that they know is going to come in and is going to get along with the other partners and the nurses and the consultants, somebody that's going to move patients. You're not going to be the slowest provider in the group. And dragging your colleague down, just picking up your slack.
But two, you got the trail of dead bodies.
Yeah. So, I mean, you got to be somebody that's going to fit into the community, you know, outside of work too. And like you said, you know, is there a reason? I mean, a reason that you're moving to, you know, Hawaii or Scottsdale? What's bringing you here other than a good job? Because there's more life in, you know, whatever city you're moving to than just work.
And it's also like the effort. I don't know if you Nate remember, like when I went to ASAP, I had no plans to interview at Scottsdale, mm-hmm. and I talked to one of, you know, Ross Rogers, who's a year ahead of us. And he's like, you should interview. And I talked to my wife. She's like, fine, go ahead and do it. And I didn't bring any slacks. I went to Nordstrom, bought slacks. I had a dress shirt. I borrowed your tie.
Yeah.
And I did my interview.
And you got the job.
And they told me, they're like, we're just impressed how much effort you put in to, like, do this interview. And I was like, it was horrible. I was hungover. I called in Zofran for you.
Yeah.
I remember. But it was, you know, it was just, you want people to show that they want to be there.
But back to the known quantity, I think it gets harder for us the farther we're at all in the same. Because we kind of just went through a hiring process. And our director likes, you know, like I said, he likes the known quantity. But it's getting harder and harder the farther we are out in terms of people that we know that we can recommend for a job. So residents that we're seeing coming out, if they're coming from Arizona, you know, that phone call is being made back to people like Jared or Aaron, and people that can give us the lowdown on what you were like as a resident to work
with. And again, remember, it's a small world. Like, we had a girl apply who had worked in Flagstaff for a few years, and I sent an email to Jamie Derman. She was like, I know Jamie Derman. And so I sent an email and said, you know, how does she work? What does she, you know, it all connects. Mm-hmm. So you're not safe.
Agreed. And for us, you know, we're very big on, like, kind of working with nurses. And, you know, part of our second round is, and I remember I had Kai do mine, was, you know, like this nurse evaluation of you. And because it matters, like
you go for your interview, introduce yourself to the nurses.
Mm-hmm. Correct. You interview yourself to the nurses, and like we have, you know, our practice administrators, like our Donna Goldberg, I know she's not here anymore, but like if you piss her off, you're just done. And we had these interviewees that I had, and she's like, this dude's on the email, and I'm like, all right, well, we're going to interview them. Mm-hmm. But it's like, you have to do just a masterful job to overcome that. And it's so easy just to be like a nice, normal, decent, polite human being.
Unless that's not who you are.
Correct. Anyhow.
It's unbelievable how far that goes. And I think we were having this conversation of just common sense and being polite, how far that will
it's crazy.
Take you in our life.
Like, can you imagine if you were mean to Donna Goldberg? Like, you know, for us, it's like
Veronica now. Veronica.
Right. And I don't know who she is, but she was, you know, way after us.
Same thing. If you were mean to her and mistreated her,
yeah, it's like
how well would you get through 3 years of residency in Arizona? You know?
Right. It's not going to go well. You're too self-important to, you know, you don't realize how important those people are just because they don't have an MD after their name.
Yeah.
And that's just not going to work well, like, especially in the community. Yeah.
The other piece of advice is, like, November, December, January hits, and everyone's freaking out that they need to have their job lined up. And I remember, you know, as a program, it's nice to say all our residents have their jobs. But in terms of good jobs, they don't all come up in the month of November, December, January. Like, someone has a baby, someone decides to retire, and they do that when it's convenient for them, not when residents are graduating. So if there's a place someone really wants to work or a group they want to get into, stay in contact with them, move to that place, take something else until you can get in, because jobs will open up, but they won't open up on a time frame that's convenient for a resident.
You guys
can open up July 1st.
You guys both did that with Bend.
Yeah, I rotated through Bend at the beginning, end of my second year, beginning of my third year of residency. I would say, you know, if there's a job that, you know, this is just the slam dunk job that I want, I would make that connection early on in your residency.
Yeah, if you can do a rotation there.
If you do a rotation, that's excellent. If you can't, just cold call them on the phone. Say, hey, I'm really interested. I want to talk to your hiring partner. And you know what? They're interested in having people be interested in them. They'll call you back. They're not going to blow you off. They want people who want to be there and do a good job.
If they're not hiring, stay in touch with them.
Yeah, so my job was not available for a year after residency, but I sent almost it was literally a monthly email to the director, say, hey, I'm still hiring, I'm still interested. Just kept sending that every month.
It's a total mistake that residents make to think that the community world works on the academic calendar, which is obviously not true. It's like you said, people are going to retire when they want. People are going to have babies, obviously, whenever, you know, 9 months after they do whatever they do. So it's just total convenience. And you can get a job that maybe you wouldn't have gotten otherwise by kind of being aggressive. and kind of just, you know, appropriately aggressive. Just kind of being like, as Frank Walters would say, pleasantly persistent. Yeah. You know,
I think any job is available over the course of time. You know, if you're a, you know, a good applicant, any job is going to open up.
And it
might not be until 5 years from now.
Yeah, right. Contacting alumni is really helpful. And I also think that there is always community politics that you don't appreciate when you're at the university. And if you don't know those community politics, you could shoot yourself in the foot. So contact those alumni.
Mm-hmm. I got to imagine you guys still keep that map of where all of your... That is huge.
Sure,
you have some alumni in amazing places and just with fantastic jobs. So if you're not taking advantage of that list, it's...
I agree. I talk to people. You get so much when I was looking for a job. I just talked to people. The amount of information that you could get from an alumni who wasn't doing the hiring was 50 times more than when you talk to the guy who's trying to hire you.
So valuable.
It's, you know, people just give you the down and dirty.
Yeah. Well, listen, we really appreciate you guys doing this for us. I was just counting up while we were sitting here talking. There's almost 30 years of community emergency medicine experience here. Sans, me, and Leach, who have no community experience.
I think I have 6 months.
We really appreciate it, and hopefully we can get you guys on next year.
Cool.
Thanks for having us.
So even though we ended with the job hunt conversation, we're definitely going to have them on throughout the year to give their experience on different things. We spent a lot of time talking with them, and it was really great perspective. So we wanted to get the job hunt stuff out for those of you that are still looking, and hopefully that was helpful to you. Very smart people. Sorry about the audio quality that it was recorded in the cave that is Jared's house. But as with everything, we're learning and getting better with time. Hopefully you can hear it this month. And for those of you that were paying attention, that people take Jared and my input, I'm actually more of a beer person, and Jared prefers apple teenies and hard cider.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone out there. Hope you're having a great November, and I'm entering one of my favorite holiday seasons, and I'm always excited to eat pie. I love me some good pie, so tomorrow I will be eating plenty. Anyway, Jared and Aaron gave two cases and some good job stuff today. Let's talk about first case. I will be easy on Jared and Aaron because I'm thankful for this opportunity, and I'm thankful that they are two good people to work with. So anyway, done with the butt kissing. So for the first case, the 30-year-old female couldn't swallow, had some pain for 5 days. I think I'll just talk about what I would do. So this was an interesting case. It kind of reminds me of my usual case that I get of a 30-year-old female who has some lymphadenopathy, says she can't swallow. I look in the back of her throat and I discharge her 20 minutes with some steroids and say, yeah, you have acute pharyngitis. But Jared finds a way to make this interesting. I don't know how he gets these cases or where he pulls them from, but this is good. So I think you have someone with dysphagia that was repetitive in nature and is having difficulty laying flat with lymphadenopathy, no obvious source. What would I do? I think the first thing I think of in a more complex patient than just a simple sore throat or something would be trying to diagnostically classify the patient. So is this really a esophageal problem, more of an achalasia or a stricture or some dysmotility issue, or is this more of a sore throat, or is this something mass effect in the neck, and trying to classify it into one of those reasons. With those, then I would do my diagnostics. I think Allie had a good idea. They did in this case as well, put the nasopharyngeal scope and take a quick look and see if there's anything massive or obstructing. I would probably have done the same thing. And then knowing that the patient can't lay flat, I would try to see if there was a reason they couldn't lay flat. Is it they can't lay flat on their back? Could they lay flat on their front? Meaning that if they can't lay flat on their back, maybe something is flipping into their airway and causing an obstruction. Could I do the CT scan with them just laying on their side? Now, radiology may not like that, but you can still lay someone on their side or even on their belly to do a CT scan. It may not be protocol and you may have to work with the radiologist, but that would be something I would consider. But say they can't lay flat at all and I really wanted to get that scan. I think the next thing after the scope I would do is probably plan for an RSI with a bougie with a backup plan for a crike. Even though they have the fat neck, I think that's something you have to think about. So that's what I would have been thinking about in this patient. The second point I think that they brought up that was good was the succinylcholine versus rocuronium debate. I'm kind of leaning more on the side of rocuronium. I can get about the same onset time with sucs and roc, depending on my dosing. And I think if you're really taking someone's airway and you really want that airway and you're really taking it, you should really maximize your chance. And to maximize that, you need to give something that doesn't create a floppy fish in front of you within 8 minutes, because then you're rushing against the clock. I think we have lots of good ways to pre-oxygenate people and do apneic oxygenation. And if you're mucking around and it's nearing that point, you're running out of ideas and this is becoming difficult, I don't want to have to think about re-paralyzing someone or re-sedating them. So I would kind of lean to roc on this patient. I haven't ever had a patient where I put down to RSI and then hope that they woke up and walked around. Maybe this is the patient because they look so good and you're just going to bag them and let the sucks wear off. But I don't know. I'd lean more towards roc. The third point from this case, I think Jared and was talking about some difficult airway algorithms and, you know, the vortex of hell and some Canadian guys and anesthesia. So mine's really simple. I modified it a couple years ago after a case as an attending, but it goes DL to video laryngoscopy to LMA to Crike. That's it. Four steps. The LMA I added because I had a tough case. I'm like, that probably would have been a smart time to do an LMA instead of going to the Crike. But VLDL, I'm not going to debate that. I think either one that you do, you can use the other as a backup or an escape. So sometimes I flip those and maybe VL is my first choice. And then along that algorithm, I throw in my adjuncts and my plans. So if I think it's going to be more difficult, maybe I'm going to do VL with a bougie and then go to LMA and then to Crike. Maybe I'm trying an awake intubation, but I usually make that awake decision before I go down my RSI normal algorithm. You can add other, you know, intubating LMA if you want. I try to keep it simple for myself and do what I'm best at, knowing that I have other options if I need to. So for me, it's just DL, VL, LMA, Crike. That's it. Simple algorithm. Come up with what algorithm you want to use. Make it simple. Make it recognizable to yourself in a sick patient that you will know what to do. All right. Good case. Next case was a 37-year-old, lightheaded, dizzy, numbness for 2 days, right-sided facial drooping, and some difficulty swallowing. So I think this is a good case because you may want to think about Bell's palsy. But for me, you need some of the facial droop and you're adding dysphagia in it, I'm thinking something more complex. And the group went through a good stroke mimic talk, so I won't add anything into that. What I would add to my differential when I was hearing this case was cerebral venous thrombosis and MS. I think multiple sclerosis, especially with the young female, various neurologic conditions that are just kind of weird, are also cerebral venous thrombosis. And so I would think about those. But I think the big learning point to take away with this is a good history and is more important than any diagnostic test you're going to do. By asking about your past medical history and getting the parathyroid, that will lead you down the right diagnostic modality and what you need to test for and where you need to image better than anything else. So make sure you focus on a good history and physical. And then I thought there was a good panel discussion with jobs and some things out in the community. As most of you know, I've been in the community before and I have some of the similar experiences and agree with a lot of the opinions of the panelists. So I think first thing, if you're looking for a job, there are four things I think you need to think about when you're looking for a job. And you, in your mind, have to rank these four as to what is most important. I think I've told some of the residents this, but the four things are location of the job, your family and their preferences. Number three would be money. Number four would be the job itself, whether it's a directorship or just it's a great job because it's only 3 hours twice a month, and that's it. That's your shift length. So you have to factor in which is most important. So is the location, family, money, the job itself. You rank those, and you start looking based on that. If money is most important, then you start filtering the jobs you're going to look for that pay the most. If your family says that they need to be in a location that is, you know, south of the Mason-Dixon line and has to have a body of water, then that's what you're going to look for a job in. If they don't care if you commute, that's something that's important. Anyway, you have to put all that and rank those. If you rank those and you find a job that fits three of the four, you should be very interested in that job. And if you find a job that fits all four of your requests in the order that you want them, you should be actively pursuing that job like the panel was discussing. A couple other things they were talking about. I think it's hard to realize when you're in residency that the emergency medicine community is a very small community. So whenever you're on these job interviews and whenever you're talking to other people, try not to burn any bridges. The people you know today are the people you're going to know in 5 or 10 years. And so even when you're turning down a job, you're going to turn it down and saying, I'd love to come work for you, but at this time, I think I need to do the other job for whatever reason. So it's not that you're saying no to them, but you're really saying yes to a different job. And that way it keeps your doors open, keeps your options open, and you're not being rude to anyone, you're not pissing anyone off in case something happens where maybe they're the only other deal in town, and so you may have to come ask them for a job one day. So don't burn any bridges. Another key point that they were hitting on is really good people will get good jobs. So if you're a good person and you treat other people with respect, including the janitors and the nurses, and you bring a positive attitude to work, people will hire you. You could be incompetent, but people will still hire you because they want someone, like they said, can I go get a beer with this person? Can I bring them on shift and have other people happy in the department? Those are things they're interested in. Your reputation is key. I know from personal experience, it is hard every time you go to a new location to start a reputation. Once you can get a good reputation, that pays more dividends than all the time that you spent working on that. When you can call that surgeon up or that consultant and talk to them frankly about a case and say, I really don't know what's going on. I've tried a lot of things. Here's what I thought about, but you know I don't usually call. They will take that much more seriously than the incompetent person saying, I don't know what's going on. Or, you know, why do I have to come in and see this one, Brian? Well, because every time I've called you, you've had to take someone to the OR. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Maybe I should come in. Those are huge things. So build your reputation, work hard at it, go the extra mile, and build up a great rapport with your consultants. Especially in the community, it's a much smaller setting. You're not dealing with residents that aren't getting paid much. You're giving these people business. You're taking care of them. They're going to take care of you because they're going to send you patients that you don't want to take care of, and they know you don't want to take care of, but they're away and they can't take care of them, and they're going to ask you for help. So you got to be able to have a good working relationship. And that's all I got. So hope everyone has a great Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you in December as we finish off 2014. Have a good one, guys.
As always, we're very thankful for Brian for coming in and doing our peer review, and I almost feel bad this month for giving him Rude as his intro music and exit music. But he deserved it from last month. So we hope you guys enjoyed this month's AZMcast. Did you like the panel? Did you like hearing from people that used to go here that now have real jobs out in the real world and aren't constantly looking over your shoulder at what you're doing? Do you want to hear more stuff from them? Do you want to hear different things? Please let us know. We're going to have some great stuff in December. As always, if you have ideas of something that you think would be good, if you have a case that you would want to come on the podcast and talk about, if you have an idea for something you want to talk about or you'd like us to talk about, please let us know and we'll try to get it on the podcast. I was asking Jared last night, do you like doing this? He goes, yeah, I really do. I look forward to doing this. I used to hate it,
And I said, yeah, me too. But it's actually become a lot of fun for us. I know that Brian likes it too. Hopefully you guys enjoy it because it's a lot of fun to put this together. I hope this is worthwhile for you. We want it to be educational. We want it to further your education. We want to include everybody, our nurses, our pharmacists, our medics, everybody that's listening. So any of you that have any thoughts, please let us know because we want to try to make this bigger and better every time. So happy holidays to everybody. Enjoy what is supposed to be winter, and we'll see you next month. Bye.